Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Panning the Stream. My name is Dan Reichert, and joining me as always is my wife, Bianca Reichert. How are you doing, honey?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. We're here on a very cold New York City day. It is, it was like 7 degrees this morning. It's a bit chilly in here. We never have the radiator on. But how are you doing? You're all comfortable and bundled up in a blanket?
I'm trying to be as warm as I can sitting on a metal chair.
It is a WrestleMania chair.
Cold room.
It is not the warmest chair. It's got a nice padded thing on it from WrestleMania 31, but it doesn't help that much. Regardless, we are here and we watched a television program for you. Well, we're halfway through it right now because that's all we can watch. It is True Detective on HBO Go, if you got that, or if you're one of those folks that still has cable or anything like that, whatever channel that's on. I don't remember how that works, but we watched it on the old Xbox. And there's going to be another episode today. If you're listening to this the day it comes up, episode 5 will be airing tonight. And we have watched episodes 1 through 4 as they have aired, and we're here to talk about it. Just starting off, how are you feeling about it, Bianca?
Very positive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't huge on the second season. I think that's pretty common sentiment. It was very confusing. Convoluted, weird story that really didn't make any sense. And I was a huge fan of the first season. And this, so far, seems to be living up to the first season, although not as, like, surreal, supernatural. It seems more grounded in reality so far.
Yeah, it's, that's the thing. The first one, there was always this feeling that at any point it could go way off the rails in a way because, what was it, Rust? Was that McConaughey's character?
Oh, I don't remember
Cole?
The names.
Yeah, and he would look away.
All I remember is his big hug mug.
He had a big hug mug and his Lone Star cans that he was always drinking. And I remember he would, like, look off and see hallucinations and things of, like, birds forming symbols and things like that. And there was always the sense that something wasn't quite right and that it could turn supernatural at any point. And to my recollection, I don't think it ever did.
Well, wasn't there that huge swamp guy that was, like, a big monstrosity man?
He was big, but there was nothing supernatural about him.
I remember really liking that season. I don't really remember anything about it other than Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson getting it on with that lady. And
wait, they both did?
No, Woody Harrelson got it on with the lady.
Oh, just Woody Harrelson.
Yeah, and I also remember the Time is a Flat Circle stuff.
Yes.
But if I was pressed on any details of the season. Oh, there was that really cool scene that was like, that had no cuts in it.
Yes.
That was fucking awesome.
That is the main thing I remember from that show. Because that's the moment it went from like the first 3 or 4 episodes. I remember thinking like, oh, I'm really intrigued. This is pretty good. And then I think it was that 5th episode it did that thing where it was that whole shootout in the house that went from like room to room. And then you realize it's all one shot. And it was like, holy shit, this might be like one of the best seasons of television
really
I've
cool.
ever seen. And it delivered by the end. I remember at the end, I was like, I am thoroughly satisfied by this show.
Yeah.
That was great.
It was really cool. Do you ever see drone racing?
Like in real life?
No, like on the internet videos.
Oh, no, but I mean like real footage. Like
yeah.
Not, quick shots and stuff, I
it's
think.
It's pretty neat. It's like amazing how the drone, or I guess the human controlling the drone, can always find a place to go with no hesitation whatsoever. It's really cool. You should check it out. But I was just thinking, because there's no cuts. It's just a fluid thing.
Oh, so like you're talking about like drone footage and stuff like from the actual drone
itself?
Yeah,
they like put a GoPro on it or something.
Yeah, like tracking shots and stuff. There are some famous ones through film history. Like I remember the beginning of Boogie Nights has a really long one. That's about the only thing I remember from film school. That had a long tracking shot.
Boogie Nights.
Yes. But we successfully watched all of season 2 of True Detective, and man, I was willing to. I wasn't as excited about, you know, Vince Vaughn and Colin Farrell as I was with Woody and Harrelson.
What
no,
about
Woody
Rachel
and
McAdams?
Harrelson. She was great. Yeah.
She was one of the three.
That is true.
She had equal billing.
I always felt like they always build it as like, okay, it's the two-person thing. Like, who's the new two-person team? And like, remember there was a whole meme of like, oh, True Detective season 2, who would the two be? And I remember it was announced as like, oh, it's Colin Farrell and Vince Vaughn are the two. So I remember all the hype leading up to that season. It was like, oh, these are the two. And then it was like, it started and it's like, oh, there's also Rachel McAdams and Weird Motorcycle Man.
Weird Motorcycle Man?
Remember the young guy that was like the bald dude that would always like ride his motorcycle and squint?
Oh man, I really don't remember much.
Yeah,
I remember Vince Vaughn's wife had the most sultry voice of all time.
Right, the red-haired lady, that was very, like, a high society, rich lady, right?
Well, I don't know about that. Because wasn't the whole thing that they ended up losing everything? And
I just seem to remember them being at some, like, rich person party for, like, real estate or something. Well, I remember her, like, standing around with, like, a dress. And
yeah, they were really wealthy in the beginning of the season. But that was just tough to follow. There was so much going on. I thought the atmosphere of that season was awesome. It was really dark. And it just didn't really go anywhere. And the twist, or not the twist, but what happened at the end was so, like, predictable.
I just remember Vince Vaughn got, like, stabbed in the desert and walked for a long time, and that was it. I know there are people, and I know there were, like, think pieces and stuff that absolutely, like, loved the season. They're like, no, you just don't understand it. If you took the time and understood it, it'd be great.
I don't think I did understand it. But if you have to put into, like, that much effort into understanding it, I don't really think.
Exactly.
You know, just because something is unnecessarily complex and you can unravel it, it doesn't mean it's good TV.
Yeah, I don't think it's impossible that there is a coherent story that is. I don't think it's nonsense, but also I don't want to spend more time than it took to watch it trying to figure out just the basic core plot of the thing.
So the showrunner, Nick Pozzo,
something like that's the guy at the end of the inside the episode stuff.
Yeah, so he had like a creative counterpart for the first season, and in the second one he really didn't. He like there was a different director for every episode, and he kind of had full creative control.
Right, it was that Carrie director that directed all 8 episodes of the first season. Right? Carrie, it's like a Japanese name. I don't remember.
So some people attribute that to why like it was kind of a mediocre season because like no one challenged him. He didn't have any. There was no counterpart there. It was just kind of him doing whatever he wanted.
Yeah.
This season does have that, so.
That's good. So yeah. They tried it for season 2, like, all right, it's all your baby. And then it's like, well, okay, maybe we need some people telling you no when you have, you know, ideas that aren't working out.
I remember there was a time there, what with how lukewarm the second season was received, that, like, I didn't even know if there was going to be a third season. I was so happy when they announced that it was filming. And I think they just filmed it like last year fairly recently.
Oh, really?
Like early 2018 started filming.
Yeah, I'm glad they gave it another shot because, you know, just one off season I don't think is enough to tank what was a really,
well,
really
of two.
Solid. What's that?
Of two seasons, if one is bad.
That's true. I guess that we're batting 50% at that point. So, yeah, maybe that's a bad rate. But, yeah, based on season 3 here, I'm very glad they gave it another shot because, you know, it's weird because, like, this one, they're definitely just giving billing to one. It's Mahershala Ali, who is 100% the star of this show. He is the main one. But we do have surprise Stephen Dorff hanging out as his buddy.
Yeah, he's really – they're both amazing actors, like, unbelievable. And I will say it's worth noting that it's Mahershala Ali and not Mahershala Ali, which is what I always thought it was.
Oh, you thought it ended with an L?
Yeah, because those two A's just blend so seamlessly into one
Ali.
Another,
okay,
right?
I see what you're saying, yeah. Mm. And it was really surprising to me, like, the actor who plays Roland West, who is Stephen Dorff's character.
Yeah.
I watched the first couple episodes.
So Stephen Dorff.
Yeah, Stephen Dorff. But I watched the first couple episodes not knowing it was him, and I was like, who is this dude? Like, this dude seems like a really good actor.
Kinda
I really like this guy.
A little bit like Greg Kinnear, right?
Maybe a little bit.
I would have thought it was Greg Kinnear if I didn't just see Greg Kinnear in House of Cards.
I guess I could kind of see that, yeah. But the only thing I've seen Stephen Dorff in was Blade, and he's the bad guy, Deacon Frost, from Blade.
Deacon Frost.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have remembered that at all.
Well, that's the only thing I remember is because, like, I liked Blade a lot when it came out. I was, like, a teenager, and it was, like, this cool, violent vampire movie. Mm-hmm. And so that's the only reason I know the name Stephen Dorff. I looked at his IMDb today, and I realized that, like, Blade's the only thing I've even really heard of with him in it. But, yeah, Stephen Dorff is back playing a completely different character, and he's amazing in it.
Yeah,
but
he's great.
But it's definitely Mahershala Ali that is the, like,
as Detective Hayes,
yes,
which is what we'll just call him from now on.
Yeah, Detective Wayne Hayes. So the whole thing of this season, and they've done this before, is a lot of time hopping. And you've got three different distinct periods. You've got 1980, when this crime happens. You've got 1990, where some new things come to light. And you've got 2015, where it's like there's like one of those very serial-type podcasts is doing a story on. I don't know if it's a podcast or a show, but basically it feels like one of those, like, hey, we're going to investigate this thing and put it out for entertainment. And, you know, interviewing, like, old Mahershala, or sorry, Hayes, about the case. And, again, new things seem to be coming to light. But I'm usually not big on makeup, like, hey, let's make you look old, or the opposite, when they try to, like, CG to make someone look young. I think it always looks a little off, and it kind of hurts with my suspension of disbelief.
Sure.
The work on Hayes here is maybe the best I've ever seen.
Oh, as yeah, far as it's aging. Incredible. Yeah, he does. It doesn't look artificial at all.
No.
And I think we have to credit not only the makeup artist, but Mahershala Ali is such an incredible actor. Like, he walks differently when he's the older guy in 2015. He breathes differently. His voice is deeper. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and it's I don't know if they name what it is, if it's dementia or Alzheimer's or...
Don't they say that at some point?
They may at some point.
Yeah, I don't know. He has some kind of issue with his
memory. Degenerative brain disease or something. And the way he plays it, like, you don't really see a lot of it coming in 1990 yet, but it's very much like he's an old man in 2015. And the way he plays it, like, Bianca, I think you and I both have had members of our family that have suffered from similar diseases. Mm-hmm. And it... The way he plays it is, it feels so legitimate. And like, they're not playing it up to like a cartoonish effect or anything. Mm-hmm. It's just things where it's like, oh, he doesn't know where he's at suddenly. Or there's the end of like the first or second episode where he just kind of like wakes up at this, like, not wakes up, but like, mm-hmm. comes to consciousness at this intersection, and the fear in his eyes and the way he plays that and the confusion. Mm-hmm. He's almost playing three slightly different characters, mm-hmm. in the show, and he does it so masterfully.
Right.
You know, the 1990 version is a little more kind of like high strung. They're having some marital issues and stuff. You know, the one from 1980 is very much like serious. Like, I think he's a Vietnam vet,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, he's very serious and everything, but he's kind of got everything together. But man, I just think he does a great, great job in this. Actually, all the actors do, from him and Dorf to the parents of the missing children.
Oh, Lucy Purcell, I just want to say, and I learned this recently, Meryl Streep's daughter.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I think she plays that role really well.
For sure.
And the Purcell father does a great job,
incredible.
Too. Yeah, I think his real name is like Scoot McNary, which is like, that seems like the name of the character.
Yeah, that's a dog's name.
Scoot
McNary.
That's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess let's talk about the plot here a little bit.
Let's go from 1980 and we'll work our way.
That sounds good. Let's do chronological, because the show jumps all over the place in every episode.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1980, it's very much, if you have heard of like the Paradise Lost documentary, which is it the West Memphis 3?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah. For those that don't know, Bianca, you would actually, you seem more well-versed in this. We've watched the mm-hmm. documentary, but you introduced me to it.
Yeah, if you have HBO Go and you're able to watch this, then you're able to watch Paradise Lost as well, because it's on there. And if you haven't seen it, I strongly recommend it. It's, I'm sure everyone, or maybe not, but anyone who's even remotely interested in true crime knows about the West Memphis 3. And Paradise Lost, it's like a three-part documentary, and people attribute that to like why they were released, because these three kids were just convicted of murder on the basis of they had long hair and listened to metal.
Yeah.
And you definitely get some of that those vibes from at least the beginning of this season of True Detective, because you have the two kids that go missing in the very beginning, and it kind of frames it as like, because it juxtaposes it with these like seniors in high school who have long hair and look to be kind of like, you know, rebellious, I guess.
Yeah, like pot smoking. Like, you know, they've got black, they literally have like a Black Sabbath shirt at one time and have to explain it, which that was a total thing in Paradise Lost, was like they wore these like band shirts and stuff.
Right, right, yeah. So yeah, I definitely got that kind of vibe. But so I guess you want to just go from the beginning? I mean, these two kids say they're going to go see their friend's dog and then they don't come home.
Yeah, so it's, I didn't realize where it was set. I kind of thought until I looked it up that it was maybe set in kind of the Bayou, Louisiana area. It's actually in the Ozarks, mm-hmm. which I'm really familiar with because that's in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this huge, well, it kind of stretches across a few states, but in my mind, it's always in Missouri. It's the stretch along like southern Missouri, tons of lakes, tons of woods and things like that.
So
it's
is
small
it like
towns.
A unique environment? Like the biome is unique. Is it swampy?
I wouldn't call it swampy. I would call it, at least the parts that I've been to growing up were very lakey and woodsy.
Mm.
And actually seeing the environments in the show and everything, like that tracks. But I do think it stretches into a few different states. So this could be further south than Missouri. But that general area, you know, the area is not a huge part of it. It's basically just kind of very rural, woodsy area.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, these two kids, you've got Will Purcell and Julie Purcell.
Mm-hmm.
I think Julie's older at the time they disappear, right?
I'm not sure. I didn't note their ages. They just look like children.
Yeah, yeah. These two kids.
Tiny kids.
Yeah, small kids. I mean, roughly 10, 12, mm-hmm. around there. They go off on their bikes, say they're going to see their neighbor's dog, and they don't return. And so their dad, Tom Scoot, he basically is calling around, trying to find him and everything. And, you know, the people that they said they were going to go see, they were like, no, we never saw the kids. And So I think the cops get involved like that first night.
Right.
And it's Hayes and West, Ali and Dorf, that were just kind of out fucking around, basically. Weren't they out just like drinking in some lawn chairs, like in some empty area when they got the call?
Well, they were probably like on patrol duty or something.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They just were waiting for a call, I would imagine.
But yeah.
There was actually that scene in the very beginning where they're sitting on lawn chairs, like in front of that, I don't know if it's a dump or whatever it was, but they see that fox. And this fox has the cutest little sad face I've ever seen. And I immediately didn't like, or at least at the jump, I didn't really like Roland because he wanted to shoot the fox. And it was so cute.
Sorry, Roland wanted to shoot it, mm-hmm. and isn't this when we learn that West was a, or sorry, Hayes was a hunter of sort? Like, he hunts boar, but in Vietnam, he was a tracker, right?
He did, like, long-range reconnaissance.
Yeah, so he's, like, really good at, like, tracking stuff and hunting, mm-hmm. but he does tell West not to shoot the fox, right?
Yeah, so the fox is spared, and I'm wondering now, knowing how True Detective goes, what the significance of that scene was, and if we might be able to pin any meaning to it now, seeing what we have seen. Maybe we should return to this when we're done talking about it.
Is this a symbolism thing that probably went right over my head?
I don't know yet. I want to work that out with you. I think okay. It has to be, right? I mean, they wouldn't have just...
So you want to loop it back around?
We'll loop back around.
Remind me later. I'm curious what you're thinking there. So yeah, they basically get put on the case, and it seems like clues are very sparse at the beginning here. We meet the parents. And Tom and Lucy. I think both of these actors are just doing a great job at just kind of portraying the kind of nightmare they're going through here.
Right.
Because it seems like there was marital strife before all this happened.
She seems to be an addict and someone that cheats frequently on Tom. And Tom seems to be kind of like a hapless, sad guy, drinks a lot himself, and they argue a lot.
Yeah, just bitter and angry, staying at home while his wife is going around drinking and sleeping around and stuff. And then, like, on top of all that was already bad, now their kids disappear. And, yeah, they're both incredible at this, and there's an interesting relationship and a lot of fun back and forth. Not fun, but, like, good. Not fun at all.
Fun.
But the way that the cops and the parents kind of play off each other in the scenes with them, I think, are really good. Because they're really – the parents are portraying this, like – hey, thank you for looking for our kids, but also, like, it's just, they seem kind of pissy at each other a lot.
Right, they're kind of each blaming each other.
Yeah, there's this tension there where it's like they're getting pissed about answering questions, but they're also like, yeah, okay, you should get out there and find our kids, you know?
So, Detective Hayes and West look around the house, just do a cursory search, this first time at least, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention how good the set design is in the show, because that, like, each era has like such an accurate set design. The 1980s, that house looks exactly like a 1980s house, right?
Yeah.
And the 90s, that looks just like a 90s house.
Yeah. There's stuff where actually in the most recent episode, they were playing, there was one of those VCR TV combos. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking at it, it was like one of those Sylvania ones or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I think we had one of those in our house.
Yeah.
And it was just so accurate to like, because, you know, I was 6 years old in 1990. And I was like, fuck, I think we had that thing.
And the Walmart in the 90s?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that I'm very familiar with Walmart in the 90s.
How do they do that? I mean, I know HBO doesn't spare any expense when it comes to, like, production, but it's got to be a huge undertaking to transform a department store like that.
Yeah.
And especially with the subtle changes that would be required to make it look like it's from the 90s.
I would have to guess, and I'm just guessing, that there are probably, like, companies that you can hire that, mm-hmm. like, specialize. Like, some, you know, company in L.A. that is like, hey, we have experts here. We have – maybe they have the props. And mm-hmm. it's like, hey, you tell us the year and we will make sure that, you know, we're not using anything past this year. Mm-hmm. We'll bring people on to kind of look at the set and make sure everything is – there's nothing – that car, you know, was from 10 years later, right, or whatever. I bet there are people whose whole jobs is to do that.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. That's a very interesting job to have. But yeah, you're right. Every era seems totally appropriate. So I'm trying to think of the first kind of break they have.
Well, I would say, I don't know if this is the very first one, but while they're in the house, Hayes is going through one of the bedrooms and he finds porno mags under the bed.
That's right.
And he finds a hole in the closet that like was recently drilled because there's sawdust on the ground. And the hole, if you look through it, you could see the daughter's room. It's like right into the daughter's room. So super duper creepy.
Yeah, and wasn't there, was it the brother? It was like an uncle or a friend or something that was staying there. What was the relation there?
So it's Lucy's cousin, but she says he treats the kids like their uncle.
That's
so
right.
They call him uncle. I forget what his name is.
So immediate suspicion on him because he's staying there for like an extended period of time.
Right. And he acts super skeezy. Like when they're talking, when the detectives are talking to him, he's talking about how like Lucy needs more of like a man in her life. Just really skeevy stuff that when we later learn that Lucy's been cheating and that the paternity of the daughter is in question makes me think that that guy is probably the father of the girl.
Right.
Which makes Tom even more of a trooper. Because he seems to be, like, aware of it.
Yeah, they bring it up, too. Is it Tom's parents at the funeral were one of the detectives asked about that? And they start crying. They're like, not here, not now. Like, we can't talk about that.
Especially, too, and I just realized this. He says that they got married, him and Lucy got married, because she was pregnant and they were young. So they got married. And it was obviously a loveless marriage from the beginning. But they had this second kid. So maybe it makes sense that the second kid came from another partner.
Oh, that she was already kind of like cheating on him. And yeah, okay. Yeah. Which we've only seen this character, the kind of uncle, in 1980, right? I feel like he hasn't really come up in 1990 or later, right?
Yeah, I think they mentioned that he's like disappeared or his whereabouts aren't known in the 90s.
Huh.
And I can't recall if he was addressed at all in 2015.
We've got half a season left. I wonder if we're going to see him pop up again.
Like, we got it. I mean, there's too much weird shit. But they, so another thing they find in the house, and I think this is actually when they return to the house later, but they search the daughter's room and they find this bag that says Hoyt Foods, where the mom used to work, and they find all these creepy notes that someone wrote to the daughter, and they figure there's some kind of connection there. So they go to the Hoyt Foods factory, and the owner has this fund because I guess someone he knows or someone in his family lost their child, and they're raising money for the search efforts for the kids. And he seemed kind of creepy to me. I don't know if he'll come back around.
The Hoyt guy in the office?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially like, you know, really rich people in small towns tend to have a lot of power. So.
I bet they're throwing a lot of intentional kind of red herrings our way.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, there was this priest in the most recent episode that they talked to, and he seems like, oh, okay, maybe this guy's up to something, or oh, maybe this uncle guy is up to something. So I think there are a few suspects here, but none that there's any real dirt on. One guy that they keep kind of coming back to is this guy, Brett Woodard, who is, they call him like the trash man or the trash guy. And in the 1980 timeline, he's like this big, I believe he's a Native American veteran that drives around in like a go-kart and just gathers trash and sells it basically. And everyone just thinks he's weird because he's just driving around in a go-kart doing this. And, you know, a bunch of just like kind of redneck type dudes are, they think he's like doing stuff with kids or something because they've seen him talking to him. But it's like, we've seen him a couple times just being like, hey, can I have those cans when you're done with them?
He seems like a reasonable guy.
Yeah, like I don't think that that guy is actually involved in any way. But I'm wondering where that goes because...
Well, we should come back to that because they leave it on a cliffhanger, the last thing we see. But Hayes goes looking for the kids and he goes with one of the search parties and he goes off by himself because he's a long-range reconnaissance guy. And he finds the boy's body in like a prayer position, dead. And there's a bunch of these creepy dolls around. They look like they're made of like corn husks. I don't know what they're made of. But so they find the kid and obviously it's like there's a mix of relief and sadness because where is the daughter now?
Yeah.
And shortly after, I think it's shortly after that, that the parents receive like a weird note, a really cryptic note that says that the girl is safe, that children need to laugh.
Yeah.
Something. So it's pretty obvious that they took Julie and Hayes suspects that she was the target all along.
Yeah, they get this very, like, classic ransom note thing of, like, ads cut out of magazines and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that it's where is Julie at this point?
Right. Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah, so this part where they find the kid, the boy's body, is the part that reminds me the most of season one of True Detective. Because we're kind of out in the woods and, like, these creepy straw dolls. I don't know if you remember, there was, like, there were all these weird kind of straw or stick things from season one. And that really brought it around to season one for me. You know, I don't think it's actually going to really tie in necessarily, but it feels that way. There's no sense this is an occult thing or if this is like a single creep or something. But all the notes that were found in the magazine, too, were really, really like just vaguely creepy.
Right, yeah.
I can't remember what they all said, but they were just very concerning.
It seems like the kind of like what's the word that people use when, like, a grooming language, like, oh, it'll be okay, you know, stuff like that. It seems like it was coming from an adult to a kid. Oh, and they also find, or it might be a little after this, but they end up going back to the woods and find a bag of toys, and it's toys that the parents didn't recognize. So obviously someone else was giving them toys,
yeah,
giving the kids toys.
So definitely a sense, everything's kind of pointing towards an adult that has been like planning on this for a while,
right,
and maybe the kids have been meeting up with and not telling the parents.
Right.
You know, who knows if they're actually going to go see the neighbor's dog or if they had like a secret friend they were seeing in the woods or mm-hmm. something.
I think we're missing a really big part where Wayne goes to the school to investigate, and that's when he meets Amelia.
Yes, yes.
And they go on a date, and it seems like, I don't know if you noticed this, Dan, but in all their scenes, if they're not like arguing, it's all they talk about is this case. It's like there's nothing else there for them other than this case. But they go out, they seem to hit it off. She assists in the investigation by like asking kids questions and making them feel comfortable and stuff because she's their teacher. She seems to allude to a mysterious past that I'm sure they will delve into a little more. I'm curious what her role is in this because, we'll get into it when we jump to the 90s, but she's, seems to be a really smart, articulate woman who is good at manipulating men.
Huh. I guess I've seen all the allusions to like, oh, I had this wild past. I used to be kind of a mess. You know, yeah. I used to be, you know, do all this stuff. I guess I hadn't thought about how that might potentially play into the story here. Mm-hmm. In my head, I was just like, oh, they're just giving some backstory on this character. I guess maybe that's another thing of me just not thinking deeper about something and not realizing.
Honestly, I would agree with you if all we saw was that date scene, but she had alluded to that prior to that as well. So the fact that they keep bringing it up.
They do, yeah.
Again, so many red herrings. You could be right that it's nothing, so.
And they keep talking about the case to the point where, like, in the last episode we saw, they are having dinner and she brings something up. And he's just like, ah, man, you're bringing work to the table here. Mm-hmm. So in the 80 timeline, she's basically like, you know, they're meeting. She's helping with the case. They're kind of hitting it off. And then in the 90s, they're married and having marital strife. And in 2015, she's dead.
Mm-hmm.
So she is definitely persistent throughout all these. But some pretty good scenes. Like, I like the actress. Some really good interplay between her and Mahershala Ali.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's a solid character so far.
Oh, you know what's a question that never got answered? Pretty early on, there was that guy that they spoke to who was a convicted sex offender who, under a different name, worked at that daycare, obviously. He's a fucking pervert.
Didn't they beat him up in a barn or something?
They beat him up. And then last time we saw him, like, he was in their trunk. So I'm curious what happened to him.
Oh, man, that's another thing. Like, man, there are so many different ways it could be and so many possible, like, suspects at this point. I mean, I guess this is probably exactly where we're supposed to be halfway through the season.
Right.
Is wondering, like, okay, who's, you know, what about that guy? What about this guy?
Yeah, I feel like if we were to make any definitive statement, it would just be, like, a wild guess. I mean, because there's so many things and the wind isn't blowing too hard in any direction. All we know is that's consistent, that keeps coming up, is that there was this fancy brown car in the area when the kids disappeared. And the guy who drove it had, like, a glassy eye. And he was with a woman.
Which they, in the last episode we saw, they find a guy that fits that description, but I didn't get any sense that he was involved at all.
Mm-hmm.
They question him for a while in this, like, trailer park, and mm-hmm. then, you know, these guys crowd around and break his window and everything, and that definitely just seems like, okay, there must be someone else fitting that description, because I think that guy had a solid alibi, too, didn't he? Like,
it wasn't solid, he just said he was at home, and you know, all the people in the trailer park were clearly fond of him and would probably vouch for that.
That's right.
And they all seem very, like, anti-police, so I'm sure anything to just get him out of there, they would have said.
Yeah.
So that's unclear, but I think they left thinking he had nothing to do with it, so.
Yeah, I wonder if we'll see him come back or if they're going to keep finding someone else that fits the car guy description, because that is something we just don't know anything about. We don't know, like, the car was spotted, and it was weird because it was a high-end car being in these kind of, like, rundown areas, mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. I have a feeling we're going to be seeing way more about that.
Oh, for sure. And this is one of those things that a detail that comes up again in 2015 when Hayes is being interviewed by that woman, when she's suggesting that the investigation was shoddy and that this, you know, these leads weren't pursued at all. And you see him in 2015, like, acting like he never heard this stuff before, but it's obviously because he's lost his memory.
Yeah.
I'm curious where it goes in 1980 and in 1990, why it wasn't, why nothing came of that, because obviously they're suggesting
that nothing
comes of it.
Oh, yeah, because like, now we know there's not going to be a scene in 1980 or 1990 where it's like, oh, aha, we found the car guy.
Yeah, at least maybe, or maybe, you know, he's just suppressing memories.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess that is kind of all the major points from 1980, except for the very last scene of the last episode, which was in 1980.
Yeah.
Where, I don't know if you want to go over what happened there. But
just in general, like, all the, like, hick guys are trying to, like, chase down the trash guy and
Woodward.
And so there's like this standoff where he's putting a bunch of guns at all the windows and puts a claymore
down. He's ready for them. He rigs up some explosives.
Yeah.
He is clearly a veteran who knows what he's doing.
Yes.
With weapons.
Yeah, and it's a pretty effective last shot is the main dude that we've seen kind of hunting him down kicks the front door open, and we know full well there's a claymore right on the other side. So that guy is super fucking dead, probably. Yeah, yeah. Well, almost certainly. But yeah, I'm wondering where that goes, because like, as of now, that whole thing with Woodard does not necessarily seem tied to anything. That seems to be like a little side story as far as like, oh, these people in the town don't trust him, and you know, he's just trying to do his trash thing. Like, I don't really know how it ties in outside of like in the early episodes when they're just kind of going off of whatever they hear. Mm-hmm. They're like, yeah, I don't know, some people think that guy's weird, but I don't think there's ever been evidence or anything, has there?
No, there hasn't been, but I wonder if this is obviously going to be a huge massacre type thing that is taking place in this town that was previously distracted by these two kids, one murdered, one missing, that I think this massacre will take precedent over it. It's like when Paula Poundstone was like convicted of, or people were saying that she molested children, and then 9/11 happened and no one remembered it, and she's still on like, wait, don't tell me all the time.
Oh, what? Who is Paula Poundstone?
She's a stand-up comedian.
Oh, wow. I had not heard any of that.
Yeah. There was some, like, weird allegations about her with, like, younger, like, minors. And,
oh, wow.
And then 9/11 happened and no one ever mentioned it.
Yeah, just no other news story is going to be heard of for, like, 15 years. Yeah, huh. So, yeah, that's pretty much it for 80, which I would say the bulk of what we've seen in this first half of the show has been 1980.
Right.
And that makes sense. I mean,
that's when everything happened, yeah.
Yeah, and the big bombshell that is kind of moving forward in the 1990 timeline is that they found, what is the girl's name again? Lou? No, yeah, Julie, you're right. Lucy's the mom. So Julie has been found, like her fingerprints were found. There was a robbery at like
a pharmacy.
Yeah, it's like a Walgreens, CVS type place. And they found her prints. They don't know if she was involved with the robbery or if she was just there. But
yeah, this new information causes them to, I guess, reopen the investigation. Or was it that they reopened it because of that information, or that like were they saying that someone was already convicted on the murder, that they were overturning it or something?
Oh, that's a good question.
Because the one detective, I forgot his name, but he was telling Roland, who's the lead on the reopened investigation, that like their goal is just to support the DA's claim. DA's
their finding or whatever.
Yeah. So I wonder if they're just going to try to reconvict the guy who was originally convicted, or if I'm just making this up, but I'm pretty sure that was mentioned. Either way, there's new information, and it's clear that Julie is still alive.
Yeah, we've actually seen like security footage for now, so it's pretty confirmed that she's out there, but no one knows what's going on. We know that West, Stephen Dorff, has been kind of like promoted. He's kind of like a big guy at the police at this point.
Right.
And it seems like he's in charge of kind of bringing some new investigative stuff in 1990. Mm-hmm. And so he calls on Hayes, Ali, who he isn't. It seems like they have not worked together very much in the last 10 years.
We don't know why yet, but it seems like he got demoted. Hayes got demoted into like a public information role.
Yeah.
So I guess we're going to get some answers at some point, what happened in the 80s to cause that to happen. So he puts Hayes on his team and they get to it. And things are pretty tense between him and Amelia.
Yes.
She flirts with the detectives to get more information on them before Hayes is brought back onto the team. And he's obviously upset about that. And things are pretty rough, and they have angry sex, and there's the book.
Yeah, she's writing that book.
So
about
that's
the case.
I think at this point the book is already out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it's curious why Hayes hasn't read it himself. He says something about like it's weird to see him written all over it.
That's right.
I'm curious what kind of narrative the book puts forth.
Maybe he disagrees with it.
Maybe he disagrees with it. So that'll obviously be answered at some point. I feel like 1990 is the biggest question mark.
Yeah.
Because something big obviously happens, because they allude to it in 2015 that something really big happens in the 90s. But from where we stand, there's not much. It's just kind of filling in the gaps. We know that Lucy Purcell died. She OD'd.
Right.
Tom Purcell is sober and credits Roland with his sobriety.
Yeah.
And then we know the new information about Julie. But is that pretty much it, Dan?
Yeah, I feel like there's really no threads to go on as far as what she was doing in that pharmacy, or there's no like theories about what she's doing or why mm-hmm. she hasn't come forward and mm-hmm. said she's alive. Like, that hasn't really been touched on at all. I have to think we're going to move into that stuff pretty quick. Like, right. I think we're still going to see plenty of stuff from 1980, but I think 1990 might be a focus going forward for a little bit here.
Yeah,
and then eventually it would make sense for 2015 to be kind of like, you know, in maybe the last episode or two of the season, like a lot of focus on that.
Right. I think it probably is worth mentioning that Amelia and Wayne have two kids, just because they have two children, a girl and a boy, and the girl seems to be absent in 2015. I don't know if she's dead or if she's just estranged.
Yeah, and the son, Henry, is around. Actually, I think they allude to the daughter at the dinner table a couple times, and like he asked several times about her, because I remember Henry hey, you've asked this.
Right.
Like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I still don't know if she's dead or what the case is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like 1990 is a really big question mark right now that I think we're moving towards. And I look forward to whatever happens in 2015 as far as what they find there.
Yeah, 2015 is, again, a huge question mark.
It's, yes.
We know that he's lost a lot of his memory. He's involved in this interview with this journalist. Again, don't know if it's a podcast or a show.
Yeah.
He has to record audio logs for himself, kind of memento style, to remind himself what he's thinking, what he's doing.
He's hallucinating, like actively hallucinating about his dead wife and mm-hmm. like the Viet Cong and stuff like right. that. Yeah.
He found himself in front of what I think was like the burnt remains of the Purcell house, but I could be wrong. Remember I think it's the end of like the second episode.
When he's at the intersection at night?
Yeah. I think that's what that was, but I could be wrong.
Yeah. And it seems like he wants to like get back to work investigating stuff. Mm-hmm. And he says to his son, like, this is how I want to stay alive.
Right.
You know, he's very aware of how his mind is slipping, but it seems like he just has to kind of close the book on this thing before
right.
he goes.
He even says to Henry, like, oh, this has been my life. It's interesting to think there are so many murders, obviously, that have happened. And for each murder, there's like a team of detectives who that murder is probably their defining case.
Yeah.
And in his case, it's something that has been like a touchstone of his entire life. Like, this incident happened with these two kids and it like engulfed his entire, all the timelines of his life, right?
Yeah, it wasn't like it was a year-long investigation. Yeah. It was something that just like kept plaguing
him. Even his wife wrote a book on it, so she was right there with him, engrossed in it. And,
Yeah, it's a fascinating concept. I think they do such a good job with it. You know, and a lot of this hinges on, are they going to pull off the back half of it?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as this episode goes up here, episode 5 will be airing. So mm-hmm. in less than a month, probably, we'll have all the answers here about the show. But yeah, so far, it's I'm very, very intrigued. They have to stick the landing for mm-hmm. me to consider this like a great season.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, like, they have been putting all the pieces down on the board in a way that I'm very, very interested in.
Yeah, it's got to be such a fucking daunting task to write something like this, because it's three different timelines. And I mean, while it's not like Westworld style where it's unclear what timeline it is, because the robots don't age, so you can't really tell.
I'm not talking about Westworld.
But like, just in terms of, there's so many moving pieces, and we know like this, we have this information in this timeline, we don't have this information in this timeline, we might have all the information in the final timeline, but all of it is missing because he's lost his memory.
Yeah.
So it's such a weird push and pull. And I think, I mean, obviously they've been focusing, I feel like most of what we've seen has been in the 80s so far, right? Would you say?
The bulk of it. I would say it's been like 60% 1980, mm-hmm. maybe like 30% 90s, and maybe 10% in modern
time. I think
that's
probably fair. Yeah. So, you know, it'll be really interesting to see how the picture gets painted as we go along.
Yes.
And fill in more of the gaps in the timelines and stuff. But so far, really, really intriguing.
Yeah. Really good stuff. I've enjoyed watching with you every Sunday night.
Yes.
And I'm not sure if we're going to, if we'll do another episode or not about the back half, but either way, I would recommend that anyone, if it sounds interesting what you're hearing, if you haven't heard it already, check out True Detective Season 3 on HBO Go. It has been a fun ride so far.
Yeah, sure.
Yes. I got to quit saying fun about horribly dark stories. Fun's not, there's other adjectives other than fun.
Yeah, let me just say, this show is very dark. There's
yes.
Like moments where there's funny quips, but it's not a even remotely a comedy. It's a very dark show.
No.
So if you're in a bad mood and you just want to dig that hole deeper, go for it. And if you're in the mood for something lighter, I don't recommend this, but it's very, very good.
It is.
If you have discerning taste.
No, oh, yes. Speaking of discerning taste.
Yes.
I want to thank our supporters here that support Painting the Stream.
Our Painting the Stream supporters?
Our Painting the Stream supporters that went to paintingthestream.com and clicked support this podcast. Basically, it's a thing where you can help us out at $1, $5, or $10 a month, or you can just do it once and cancel. That's totally fine. But it really, really helps us. We put a lot of time into this podcast, and it's great to see that, you know, we got a modest following, and everyone that listens, we appreciate, and also the people that support us. Huge thank you. And we have a new supporter this week that we've got a bonku for. So,
indeed.
Bianca, why don't you tell us about our new supporter and let us know the bonku.
So this supporter, his name is Sydney, which is an interesting name. It is the name of a place in Australia, I think. It is the name of this person, obviously.
That's true.
Although it is spelled with a I instead of a Y, which is an intriguing choice by his parents.
I feel like the name Sydney, I usually see I, and I only see Y with the city, typically.
Okay, maybe I just never seen this name before.
Perhaps.
Yeah,
it's
that
a good
could
name.
Be it. I don't think I've ever met someone with that name.
Yeah.
I assume it's a he. If it's a she, I'm sorry. But just listen, I got limited info here.
Right.
I'm doing my best. So Sydney, I wrote for you a little bonku as a way of expressing our thanks for your delicious contribution to the cause being us talking about shows.
Doing a podcast.
And, yeah.
Talking about Netflix shit.
So yeah, it's really sweet of you. You're a great person. Obviously, it's very considerate for you to take the time. You're obviously busy day to do that. And this is our way of saying thanks. Dan, are you ready?
I'm ready.
We count on Sydney. Like a sunrise to the earth, he is a promise.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Thanks.
That's a good one. That's for you, Sydney.
That's all for you, bud.
That's straight from Bonk's heart.
It is from my heart.
It is.
I ripped it out of my soul and slapped it all bloody on the table for you.
Okay, well, that's more graphic than I expected. But there you go, Sydney. Thank you very much for your support and to everyone else that
thanks,
listens
Sydney.
Or supports us. And if you guys have recommendations or suggestions or anything, you can follow us at Pan the Stream on Twitter, or you can email us at panningthestream@gmail.com. Let us know what you think. You can review us on iTunes, give us the old 5-star, tell us you like the show, or if you don't like the show, let us know. But seriously, thanks everyone for listening. We love putting this on for you guys each and every week.
Do you have any recommendations before we go?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I guess. Here's a crazy one.
Lay it on me.
Reading books.
I noticed that your recommendations are often not specific and usually just general concepts.
Breathing in and then breathing out. In tandem. It's great. It's like peanut butter and jelly. I know, but hey, you know what? Right before we started this, I was like, oh, do I have any suggestions? And the first thing that came to mind is, I'm reading books now.
It's true. Dan's been reading a lot lately.
Yeah.
I'm usually playing video games in the evening, and he's reading for hours. And
I love it.
It's interesting because when I met you, you weren't much of a reader. Oh. And you've taken to it recently. And to see because it's such a recent development and it's so come on so quick and so strong, I could definitely tell the contrast between pre-book Dan and post-book Dan. And I would say that post-book Dan is happier.
Whoa.
He's calmer.
Really?
He's more confident. He smells better.
Jesus.
He tells better jokes.
Oh, my God.
He gives better back scratches.
Are you just saying all this because you want to play Breath of the Wild on the big screen? And I'm usually taking up the TV. Because it's working.
well, I'm happy for you. You should say the name of the book that or the books that you've been reading.
Yes, this kind of started with Bonk getting me In Cold Blood for Christmas, which I knew a lot of that took place in Kansas, but I didn't know a decent amount of it took place kind of near where I grew up.
Yes, and, very, very odd.
Yeah, excellent true crime book. I think I may have suggested that specific book on a previous episode. I'm not sure.
You also read Devil in the White City.
That's right. I read Devil in the White City last year, and that was incredible.
You read that true crime book that your father recommended about that guy who got killed. Like,
In Broad Daylight. Yeah, that's in Missouri. I've read a lot of true crime that took place in the Midwest, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where the best true crime – it's the Midwest and California.
Okay, yeah, I can see that. And right now I'm about a quarter of the way through Slaughterhouse-Five, which I'm enjoying quite a bit. I might get a good way through it tonight. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just pick up a book and read it. And it's, you know, I used to always just be like, get home and just nothing but video games until the moment I go to bed. That mm-hmm. was all I knew my entire life from being a little kid to now. And hey, there's still plenty of time for video games, and it's still a major passion of mine, but I can add another thing to the pile there, mm-hmm. and I think a good old book is a nice thing to do.
Yes.
How about you?
So, Dan, you know I'm a big fan of the band Death.
Yes.
And I was looking on the streaming services for something to watch when I was home alone the other night and wanted to watch something that I know you probably wouldn't enjoy. And I found Death by Metal, which is a documentary that's streaming on Amazon Prime. And as you could probably guess, it was a documentary about the band Death. And it's a really interesting story. If you're at all curious about the origins of death metal and technical death metal and prog death, it kind of all started with the band Death and Chuck Schuldiner, who unfortunately died. And it's a crazy story. It's really good. Amazing musicians on there talking about their craft. I strongly recommend it.
Is it a good mix of like archival footage and like current interviews and things like that from totally. People who knew him? Mm-hmm. Yeah, people in the band. I assume most of the rest of the band is alive?
Yeah, I mean, the band, Chuck Schuldiner was like the one mainstay in the band. Like, it was a different personnel every record.
Was it like a Queens of the Stone Age? I see like the Josh Homme of it. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Yeah, so.
Cool.
Very good.
Check that out if that sounds interesting to you. And that'll be it for this week on Painting the Stream. But we will return next week, next Sunday, as always.
We'll never stop.
Never, ever, until we're dead in the ground. Ooh. We can't make promises.
No.
No, we can't. But we have no plans on stopping, so just...
We'll be sure to let you know if that happens.
If we stop or if we die.
Both.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right, we should go now.
Okay, we should leave. All right, thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you. I love you, Dan.
Bye, I love you, honey.
Oh, thanks, Tom Honda.
Thanks, Tom Honda, for the theme song. Bye.